us as a people, as a society, as a nation, and as a community of nations, is that of environmental ethics and environmental sustainability. The scientists tell us that in as little as two decades, that the Earth may have reached a point of irremediable change or irreversible change, that it may have reached a point whereby we may no longer turn back the clock, that we can no longer fix the damage that we have done unto it or to her. So the question now is a great one. What we face today, again, in as little as two decades' time, we may have passed the point of irreversible change. What we face today is the threat of human and environmental disaster. That life as we know it may change, that we face these deadly horrorists, if you will, that we'll look at in a few minutes. And we face the threat of the utter annihilation of not only the planet, our species, our ecosystem, our biosphere. This is what we are facing today. And what we see is that this is the moment of crisis, and in this crisis, there is that opportunity. That as we seek for a way to reconnect or to connect differently with nature, there is that opportunity. So even under the very best of circumstances, what we see is that we are dealing with a world of limited resources, a world of a geometrically expanding population, a world where people are wanting more and more things, both in the developing and developed world. And of course, we are not dealing in the best of all possible worlds because we are continually despoiling that nature, continually despoiling that environment. And so things are coming to a head where we must make some decisions. Before we delve deeply into this, we have to address a few simple terms. Environment. What is the environment? Well, we may consider the environment the totality of circumstances that surround us, the totality of factors, objects, and conditions that surround us. We're talking, of course, about living organisms. We're talking about biotic factors. We're talking about the ecosystem. We're talking about the biosphere. When we talk about ethics, what are we talking about? We're talking about good and bad, right and wrong. We're talking about moral obligation, and we're talking about duty. When we're talking about sustainability, what are we talking about? We're talking about the capacity of the environment to endure, the capacity of the ecosystem to hold, bear, and endure the organisms, the life forms within it or within her. Environmental ethics, so we're dealing with the right and wrong way in which we can relate to our environment, those conditions, factors, objects which surround us, and we're dealing with the sustainability of that environment, again, the ability of that environment to bear us, living organisms, beings, living beings. Now, a key term, if you will, or a key definition was laid out in the Brundtland Report in the United Nations 1987. And it posits that which is sustainable is that which meets the needs of the present generation without affecting the ability of future generations to also meet their needs. And so what are these deadly factors that we spoke about, these five horrors? The first may be said to be war. Now, it would seem that war has always been among us, that it has always been there. And yet, what we face today is the prospect of nuclear and chemical warfare which can permanently affect our environment, our home, our biosphere, our ecosystem, to irremediable levels. Famine. We're dealing with a situation where 6 million children under 5 die every year of hunger, where 840 million individuals are malnourished in the developing and developed world, 800 of them in the developing world. We're dealing with a situation where 1 billion people around the globe go hungry. It's interesting to note in this discussion of famine in the literature that it was noted that famine seems to be something that is prevalent in only certain kinds of governments, that in dictatorships and imperious regimes where a people is subjected is where we have famines, and a famine has never occurred in a liberal democracy. And of course, famines cause social unrest and a breakdown in the social order. Pestilence, of course, refers to those plagues of locusts and grasshoppers, of insects or pests. Now, of course, this may seem to be something that is a function of the natural world, and yet what we see is that social causes, man-made causes, also lead to these things, such as deforestation and draining of the marshlands. Disease, a generation ago, was once thought to be a thing of the past, something that would be annihilated by the medical profession. And yet what we see is that disease is stronger than ever, that disease has not been eradicated, but moreover, what we see is that there are these diseases called emerging diseases, which the medical profession is watching out for, which may be examples, the bird flu and the swine flu. Moreover, in the Western world, we see that disease is prevalent. We have cancer, we have lower respiratory disorders, and cancer and heart disease, of course. And of course, the environ-mer, the fifth harvest, if you will. These are environmentally related nightmares that can, again, radically transform our planet and change life as we know it. And there are no less than 7 kinds of pollution that we may speak of. We may speak of water pollution. Our water supply polluted by toxins being dumped in our fresh water. We may speak of land pollution, overgrazing, deforestation, agriculture mismanagement, increased use of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, erosion, urban sprawl, strip mining, etc. We may speak of solid waste pollution, which Americans more and more are producing more of. We may speak of noise pollution, which may seem like a relatively innocuous thing, but we wonder, in these cities, the effect that noise pollution has on the condition and state of our minds, how that might affect an already agitated mind and aggravate prevailing situations. We may speak of celestial pollution. These are around or near the Earth's orbit, it's a veritable junkyard of satellites and whatnot. And of course, may speak of air pollution caused by both nature and humanity. Nature with respect to volcanoes, and of course, with our addiction to carbon fuels, of course, we have air pollution and any number of methods that we produce air pollution. We may speak of chemical and nuclear pollution, again, which may radically transform our planet and despoil the land for ages to come. And of course, we may speak of climate change. Now, one thing is indisputable with respect to climate change, and that is that the globe is getting warmer, and that we humans are certainly aren't helping the situation. Now, we speak a lot in the parlance of the ancient ancient wisdom, that ideas rule the world. And what became clear to this student in investigating this situation is that our world today has been created due to the prevalent or dominant ideas of the day. That literally, that ideas have crystallized a certain condition or situation, and that there is, and that the foundation that permits us to act in such a way to our environment is due to, again, certain prevailing or fundamental ideas that are dominant or in a ascendancy. Let's consider a couple of verses from the Bible. Genesis 1:26, and God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. Genesis 1:28, and God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Genesis 1:29, and God said, behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of the tree yielding seed, and to you it shall be for meat. And so what we see is that this recurrent idea of dominion, of subduing, that somehow that it all has been given to us for us to do as we will. And that is precisely as we have done. Now, some may say that we have simply misunderstood or misconstrued or strayed from the teaching. But what is clear is that this has not helped our relationship with the environment. It has not held it in abeyance or suspension, or it has not tempered it whatsoever. And indeed, what it would seem is that it has provided that intellectual foundation where we feel justified to do whatever we will with our earth that we have been given dominion over. And so here we have the opportunity, because here we have philosophers and intellectuals and professors of forestry and land management who are struggling to put us upon a different intellectual footing, a different philosophical basis, a different ethical foundation where we can have a different relationship to the environment, a different relationship to environment, a different relationship to nature. And again, there lies the opportunity. And in a survey of the relationship of the literature, what we see is a groping, a struggle by these intellectuals, by these philosophers, by these ethicists, to come to a new understanding where you may have a new relationship with nature. And again, this is severely needed because we are at the brink of catastrophe, at the brink of destruction. And if a new consciousness does not arise, then catastrophe is literally unavoidable. So some of the obstacles that we face to generating this new understanding or a new framework, a new consciousness, may be said to be anthropocentrism. This is the idea that man is the center of the world, that it's all about us. Again, this idea of dominion, of subduing, that the environment, that nature exists and has value only as it pertains to us. That nature is not intrinsically valuable in and of itself, but rather it is valuable because what we can exploit from it, what we can get from it. Well, there is the opportunity to rediscover or to recommit or to see these ideas as the basis for a re-engagement with our environment. The idea that all is one, that reality is fundamentally of one homogeneous essence, that we may look out into the world and we may see diversity, we may see differentiation, but at the root of nature, at the deepest level of our being, that there is only one reality. If we would hold this, this would give us a different engagement with the environment. The idea of law, the idea of evolution, that everything is an evolution, that all beings are the same in kind but differ only in degree, that nature and the environment are not there for us to exploit, but rather everything is evolving. Everything is monadic in essence and is undergoing that development which that form permits. And so this gives us a new relationship with nature, an understanding, a respect, a seeing of the divine, of seeing spirit in nature, and seeing, again, a different engagement or relationship with that, that in that unity, in that lawful universe, in that evolving universe, where all is undergoing its own evolution, we can seize upon this opportunity where we are groping after a new understanding, a new framework to reconnect with nature, and look to these ideas as that framework where we can actually reconnect on a truly spiritual basis.
Not enough time. Somebody gets me off. Your questions and comments. Yes.
This is such a huge question and an environmental idea. And it's just interesting because at the end of what was just being said in regards to the theosophical ideas about all is evolving, it seems that karmically we're all put here at this period of time for a specific lesson, you know, as we all know that. So when we're looking at the environment, and then there's that half of, there's that camp that says, oh, you know, if we're looking at the past, this has already happened before, and it's just another cycle. So how do we put that whole piece together? Well, maybe it is just a cycle, and karmically we're here to affect each other. So it's just like, how do we put all these little pieces together?
How do we put which pieces together?
No, the idea of karma, and that people are saying that, oh, don't worry about it, you know, the earth will fix itself, it's done this before. So, you know, we're just having difficulty putting all these different aspects of this gigantic question together, if we can.
So the question asked is, how do we put it together? People have said that it has all come before, and how do we act, if you will? Well, we have used our wonderful intellectual minds to such a degree that we have gained that power where we are able to destroy the environment to a degree or condition that perhaps was not power, that was not possible before. So that has changed. And yes, indeed, we are put here karmically at a certain point in time, and it is our collective karma. So it is a moment of crisis, it is a moment of challenge, but it is also a moment of opportunity where we can begin to make different decisions. I mean, even if it's on the grassroots level, on the individual basis, even if it's on our individual thought plane, we can set in motion those causes, even if it's within disparate nucleuses or nuclei, whereby things can begin to change. Because if things don't change, if we don't evolve a different conditions, then we will be at the brink of catastrophe. And these disaster movies will be a reality.
Yes.
Well, some of us, maybe amateur drummers or read magazines about, and recently we read about the very baseline interferometer, big words, that is about dishes or telescopes is bigger than this building. One in Puerto Rico, one in North Africa, one in India, one in the Hawaiian Islands, all aimed outside of our galaxy. And they say that they do that to lock into a stationary group called a quasar. And now they can measure the life of the Earth, its movements, and predict earthquakes, predict tsunamis, all sorts of eruptions, even predict oncoming of disease. So what we gather from that, in light of what's been said here at this point, that indeed, as above, so below, but we, as thinkers, as spiritual beings, are above. And it's, I think that you're saying that how we think and act can affect and cause tsunamis and earthquakes and things like that.
How do we reconcile the correlations between what science observes as laws of nature and our reaction on those laws as thinking beings? That's a basic question.
I'd actually like to address the last part, or the last item of what you said, which is our ability, our thoughts have a great effect on our Earth, specifically earthquakes, floods, tsunamis, and whatnot. The teachings clearly posit that the brain is a great dynamo, a great engine of thought and form. And so just as our thoughts have a great power to affect our physical organism, and we can feel the stress, our thoughts generate stress and affect our physical body, in that same way, our collective thought also addresses the physical environment outside of us and can generate such things as earthquakes, floods, tsunamis, and whatnot. So in a very real sense, we are creating these disasters in the here and now.
Yeah, I just wanted to state that I feel that for man to have dominion over anything is about the biggest hazard that's been contrived, and an example being reflect and look at the tens of millions of horses that have been killed in battle over the millennia because we don't know how to practice conflict resolution. So my question would be that maybe a dominion ought to be replaced with something like reverence. Can you comment on that?
That perhaps dominion ought to be replaced by something like reverence. Most certainly, most certainly. What the mystics and seers tell us throughout the ages is that reality is one, that this world is suffused by a spirit, that everything is alive because everything is fundamentally spiritual. So if we have that perspective, we will certainly have a reverence for the environment and for nature. And what we see is that the ancient peoples definitely had that reverence, and they did not have notions of private property, of this is mine, such as we have, a commodification or a monetization of everything, but there was that reverence. So if we can begin to consider that divine dwells in all things, then yes, we will certainly have that reverence, which is necessary to a new engagement with nature.
Yes. So the best I've heard that summed up is to view life as it is a thou and not a that. So the minute you think of the other person as another living, you know, ultimately rephrasing what you're saying. But you also touched on something that I wanted to ask without waiting. The idea of gaining from others, and earlier it was mentioned that war has always been among us. So far as what we know from archaeological science, there have been different types of war. And there's definitely a certain war that is not as old as humanity. The
Well, not particularly.
The Bhagavad Gita speaks of lawful war, and it's a metaphor for the human condition. Krishna tells Arjuna that there is no duty higher for the soul than engaged in lawful war, overcoming the lower elements of our nature. So certainly, war does not have to be one of absolute conquest. We'll take one more question.
Our understanding is you know, as karma works on a global scale for all of us, for us to really get to the next level beyond that which where we were during the time of Atlantis, when they pretty much wiped themselves out, or we pretty much wiped ourselves out, for us to grow and learn beyond where we were then, isn't it true that in a twisted kind of way, we have to recreate those conditions? Because without the same conditions to receive the karmic lessons that we failed to learn last time, we'll never be able to learn them. So it almost seems like we're recreating these conditions on purpose. But the real question is, how do we know what to do and when to do it the right way so that we overcome rather than subject ourselves to our own foolishness?
So it seems that we've been at this point before, and we seem to have to recreate this condition so that we can have the opportunity to do it differently. So what do we know what to do and when to do it, if you will? Well, this era of great change, crisis and opportunity, was foreseen. And one of the reasons why the ancient wisdom has been represented at this time is precisely as a safeguard for that. This growing psychism, these incarnating souls that are coming back with this knowledge, knowledge of our ability to destroy things on a vast scale, in a different way, but still on a vast scale. And so these teachings are there as a prophylactic, if you will, as a preventive mechanism, so that if we can permeate our minds, our collective minds, with these ideas, these fundamental ideas, which by the way, is a certain mindset which is diametrically opposed to the current status quo mindset. If we can permeate the mind of the race, or at least a nucleus, then we can begin to think differently and have a different consciousness and therefore act differently. Because everything comes from a certain foundation, from a certain consciousness. If we change the ideas that we hold, we change the consciousness, then we change our actions.
Thank you. Can we have the lights? We're going to move now to the next presentation on mind science, consciousness matters. We know that we don't always learn from reading books, from listening to lectures. Much of what we learn is from experience. Not all research takes place in a laboratory. Some takes place in the field of human experience. So we're going to devote the first part of our presentation to this short film, which I think will make all the points I have to make. I'm going to tell you why it happens, but we'll make the points in a way I think you'll enjoy and remember. Thank you. One of the signs of our times is that we have before us scientists who are trying to discover in the laboratory and research why we are all interconnected, why the attitude of one affects another. And in the meantime, expand our understanding of consciousness, its mystery, what's its nature, where does it come from? Well, consciousness has always mattered to human beings because we are all aware of that we are self-consciousness, that we're aware that we're self-conscious, and that's always available to us. It's the one fundamental reality of our being. The subjective and objective experiences in our life come and go and have a relative reality, but that which is aware of these experiences is enduring. According to theosophical teachings, consciousness is not only the fundamental reality of our being, but it is the fundamental aspect or basis of the universe. All is consciousness expressed through a form and evolving under the rule of law. And it is consciousness and the laws of consciousness expressing itself in form that should be an object of scientific research and is becoming a significant area of research. Mind science is now beginning to investigate the mystery of consciousness itself. Up until this point, psychology has investigated the brain and the mental phenomenon of the consciousness. Because of that prevailing materialistic notion among scientists that the brain is the source of consciousness and the mental phenomenon that are within it. So the challenge for mind science today, a psychology, if you want to say that, is dealing with the materialism of our age. But the great opportunity that lies for mind science is the advancements in the physical sciences, or physical understanding of life, which has sort of opened the door. Because instead of the brain being the conditioner of consciousness, what research shows it is consciousness that really conditions how we experience our reality and what we believe to be real. So that looking at this table, we believe that matter is solid, or we think of matter as being discrete particles. But that's not the real situation. Physical science now understands that what we call matter is an illusion. It is really wave forms of energy that are organized by enduring fields, and that what we call empty space is not really empty. It is a large field, or planum, if you will, full of electrofields and information. And the fact of the matter is, because of this underlying planum or field or fullness, we are all interconnected. Consciousness is more like that underlying, enduring, limitless field that organizes matter and the laws of nature, rather than it is of the brain. We might say, in the terms of the philosopher then, consciousness is more like spirit. And we'd like to bring you a few areas of scientific research that demonstrate this. Just as scientists now think of a great organizing field, every body has its organizing or bioelectrical energy field. Of course, this has been studied to the greatest degree in the human body, but beginning research is done on the Earth and extended to other bodies as well. But the bioelectrical energy field, or the biofield, is a dynamic organizing field of electrical magnetic energy within and around the body. It is affected by the way we think and feel. It is affected by our emotional state or meditative state. And scientists can now demonstrate this because the field can actually be photographed and measured as how it responds to our different thoughts and feelings. So that the light that is emitted from this field through the palms of our hands is increased when a person goes into a state of meditation. And the energy that it was emitted from that biofield of an individual can have an effect on other organisms, such that controlled studies show that in a meditative or directive intentional state, this energy can be so enhanced that it will increase the growth of microorganisms to a greater degree than they might normally grow if not affected that way. So that they've developed a new understanding of physical symptoms. A physical symptom is the expression in the body of this electromagnetic disturbance in the biofield, which causes a disruption in the flow of energy. And we might say the opposite is true of health, that health shows a coherence, a balance in this underlying energy field. This is particularly started by such organizations as HeartMath, but there's others, as they study the bioelectric field that is generated from the heart. That this heart-generated biofield can be influenced by our feelings, and that it can influence the feelings of others. Just as we've seen the effect of one person's attitude and laughter on the group in their proximity. Children taught to meditate and sort of generate a stronger bioelectric field from the heart affect the bioelectric fields of other students in their classroom, and together they perform better in all academic areas than a class of their peers. So when we are frustrated, this bioelectric field is compressed and has effects on the brain waves, and when we are appreciative in a more compassionate state, it is synchronous. There are certain interesting intention studies. For example, the National University of Mexico has done 50 controlled trials where they've had pairs of individuals who meditate together in an enclosed Faraday cage. They then separate those individuals and they go into a state of meditation. One individual is randomly stimulated, either by an electrics, a sound, a light, a probe, and then they measure the other individuals who are in a different room, cannot see or hear, as to the response of their brain. And what they see is that in 25% of the cases, far above chances, at the exact time the person in the meditative state in another side of the room is being stimulated, the other person's brain waves are being evoked at the same time. It sort of reminds us of those studies that Cleve Baxter did on the leaves, where the leaves hurt. If they measured the field around the electropolygraphic stimuli of that leaf, and another leaf in another room, it responded at the harm done to the other leaf. The Institute of Electrical Engineers in England did an interesting experiment examining the effects of healing. How do healers operate? Whether they're spiritual healers or do some type of non-local healing or even in the same proximity. And what they saw is that healers, natural healers, they function in a typical pattern in their brainwave. And when they are having a healing effect on their individual, the patient goes into the identical brainwave pattern as that, as the healer. We remember a judge's statement in The Ocean of Theosophy, how telepathy and the transfer of influence from one mind to another occurs when there's a sympathetic vibration that occurs between the two. And the final example we want to give is, you may recall, on May 20th, 2007, a Global Peace Meditation Prayer Day, where 1 million people around the world joined together in 65 countries to meditate or pray about peace. They did a brain synchronization experiment in Italy as part of this, where eight meditators in one city in Tuscany, separated by eight meditators in another city in Milan, several hundred miles away. They both meditated at the same time, the same ideas, and there was exact brainwave pattern in one group and appeared in the other group, much more than what occurred by chance. So what we're beginning to see is that our consciousness is not limited to the brain, that there is a medium called a field, called spirit, in the terminology of the philosophers, that unites us all. So in our thoughts, in our consciousness, we are all one, even though in the form we seem to be separate. So we invite your comments and questions on this item. Yes?
In reference to the ethics and environmental ethics, doesn't each kingdom have a sin consciousness of its own so that many times if we go into nature, we can settle our mind and we can become calm? Now, man being at the pinnacle of evolution, we affect our environment.
The question is that consciousness is present in all the kingdoms to a different degree as spirit, that divine essence is present in all kingdoms. It is the basis of our oneness. You remember in the one experiment where the individuals went into meditation, a meditative state, and they could enhance their bioelectrical field in such a way that it influenced the growth rate of microorganisms. Now, we don't think of microorganisms as being able to consciously respond to our thoughts. And yet, in that meditative state, those microorganisms thrived, whereas when they were just growing on their own, they did not. And of course, other studies have even shown how water, a crystallization of water, responds to the quality of our thought. So all the kingdoms, mineral, vegetable, animal, and of course human, respond because consciousness is pervasive.
Well, it sounds like that could be a two-edged sword if these microorganisms are going to grow, you know, within the individual who can create these conditions within themselves, because don't we have both builders and destroyer microorganisms within ourselves, and how do we know which one's getting the right signal?
So example given in the scientific research is, of course, microorganisms growing in a petri dish. The kinds of life lives that are referred to are actually the beings that build up and innate these microorganisms. And there is a subtle balance between the two, the creators and the destroyers. But we're taught in the philosophy that by our thinking, by the quality of our thought, we can affect the balance of these two. And there are examples of individuals who through stress, extreme stress, can cause a premature aging of the hair or the tissues of the body. And likewise, there have been taught meditative practice that prolong the health of the body. So when we say that we are vulnerable to diseases, well, yes, there may be infectious diseases out there, but there is much that we do into our own natures, electrically, magnetically, and thought-wise, that make us attractive or repulsive of those conditions. Not everybody is affected the same way in these environments. Yes?
It makes sense to me that, I mean, I believe that we are kind of juvenile creators ourselves. And there's like the earth as is one soul. We are all the juvenile creators that are meshing with that. And I think that maybe the certain organisms and diseases are actually our creations that are kind of intermingling with, you know, in this playground of the earth. And that's how certain things, is there any theosophical basis to that?
Well, the idea that we create the conditions by which life becomes viral to us in a negative context. This morning, the idea of the astral light was mentioned to us. Well, the astral light, the part of that astral light that is closest to this physical manifestation is the mirror or the recording medium of the lowest impressions and tendencies of our nature. It not only records, but it reflects back to us in waves or epidemics of thought and feeling, even of illness, those impressions. So that we are the creators of our diseases. In fact, it is said that even if we use our minds to influence our body in such a way to suppress the affection, the appearance of diseases, unless we get to the cause of those diseases, which is our thoughts, they will only come back in fuller force. And in fact, it was stated that we've not yet received the full effect of the karma of our misuse of nature in Atlantean time. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that regard. Yes?
But we're also told that these lives have a memory and intelligence of their own, so that when we impress them, they retain it, don't they?
Yes.
So they will come back at us.
Yes. So all life is conscious intelligence. We're speaking of different degrees of expression. They will retain that impression and give it back to us, depending on how deeply it's formed. Now, you notice that when the monk stopped laughing and left the train and went into the other train, the lack of his presence in that car, the laughter began to subdue, but you still saw that the impression was still there. And probably for any one of you, if you recall in your mind the image of that monk laughing and smiling, the people, you can recreate in your own nature the very impression that you felt while you were watching that movie. So that, yes, our natures are magnetic, electromagnetic, and retain impressions and give them off. But not, unfortunately, not just the positive ones, but the negative as well. One more question.
There is a group we read about that exists where they go just to laugh.
Yes.
And they don't tell jokes, they just go there specifically to laugh. And when you get a good belly laugh going, it invigorates you and it does wonders. It does wonders.
It's wonderful. It's been sometimes said that we are really living in a contest of smiles. We can use our minds in very positive ways. Perhaps the main message of this picture for us is to show once again the power of one individual. The impact of it does not mean we go into this next Sunday or into a New York or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. and start laughing, but that by even smiling or entertaining and holding on to positive ideas through the interconnectedness of our inner fields and our consciousness on inner planes, we affect and uplift the light around us. So we talk about these ideas theoretically from this platform this morning, but if we take the lessons learned and hold on to them and generate them and put them into thought action, into feeling action, into speech action, into physical action with our deeds, one person can affect a large number of people around them. And that effect is contagious. It becomes viral. Okay, so we'd like to move to our next presentation. Perhaps you've understood from the ideas presented that theosophy is presenting truths of nature, which from one point of view are very ethic and moral and have a religious nature, and from the other point of view can be affirmed and researched scientifically. We know at the time HPB wrote there was differences of approaches and conflict between science and religion, and we're beginning to see today the breakthrough, the beginning of dialogue between individuals in both these fields looking for a common understanding. And that, of course, in doing that, they are facing tremendous challenges within their fields as well as opportunities. So our next presenter will talk on this new dialogue, global dialogue, the unity of science and religion.
Can't promise belly laughs, but we hope to at least have a smile or two for the audience. Thank you for coming back after lunch and listening. Imagine a time when the Roman Catholic Church demanded strict adherence to its dogma and forced by the violent threat of the Inquisition. Fear of heresy was in the air in the early 1600s, and yet this is the time Galileo chose to start questioning that dogma, fear of death, but his intention was to seek to understand through a study of the heavens how that would apply to man. inspired by Copernicus before him, that the earth was not the center of the universe, as the church held, rather that it moved in regular cycles, as did all the planets. Revolutionary for his time. His early experiments laid the foundation for modern physics, and his observations revealed new truths about the universe. Some 250 years later, at a time when spiritualism was rampant, we see the rebirth of the theosophical movement due to the work of H.P. Blavatsky, William Hugh Judge, and others. They would bring back to the world the universal ideas of brotherhood among all, ethics above all, and altruistic work for all. And you'll hear threads of what you've heard all day in my talk. Skip forward now just a few years to 1917, and we find a gentleman in New Zealand, Ernest Rutherford, seeking to find the basic unit of life. And it is said he was the first to split the atom. So that which was the smallest point yet found, he split. And of course, this led to all kinds of ideas in science that hadn't been thought of before. And he became known as the father of nuclear physics. In his scientific work, he discovered that radioactivity, a form of energy, involved the transmutation of one chemical element to another. We just saw a transmutation in the film. And the 1930s and 40s, our very beloved Professor Albert Einstein would give a series of four talks on science and religion. His articles would appear in the New York Times Magazine and later in a book titled The World as I See It. Just a little light reading. Interestingly, there is talk that there was a copy of The Secret Doctrine in his home found upon his death. Not for sure, but that was what we heard. Einstein states the following: everything that the human race has done and thought is concerned with two ideas. This is what we want to work on: the satisfaction of deeply felt needs and the assuagement or relief of pain. Deeply felt needs and relief of pain. Feeling and longing are the motive force behind all human endeavor and human creation. So let's look at deeply felt needs. Questions like, what is my purpose here? How can I understand this universe I see? Can I fit myself to be of service to others? We see a blending of science and religion. Or perhaps the deeply felt need is to understand the universe in a way that makes sense to a scientist, through reason, through proof, through conclusion. Yet when the answer becomes apparent, why is there always another deeply felt need? The answer is never final. So facts lead us in a direction, offer a suggestion, and yet it is faith, reasoned, and through efforts that produce proof, which keep us ever searching to higher and higher levels of understanding. The scientists would not admit it, but it must be there for that search to continue. So the relief of pain, deeply felt needs and the relief of pain. Yet the Buddha says all life is suffering. Pain is the contrast necessary to wake us out of our haze, the familiarity of understanding just enough so that nothing will change. But we all know everything must change. Everything must evolve. Everything moves forward. So in this struggle with suffering, we learn to meld the facts with the intuition waiting to be called upon, as this is the storehouse of everything we have learned so far. We fit ourselves to be in the moment when the two blend and understanding becomes possible. So Einstein also postulated that we don't need the anthropomorphic idea of God to understand religion. He called it a cosmic religious feeling. The quote, the individual feels the futility of human desires and aims, and the sublime and marvelous order which reveal themselves both in nature and the world of thought, individual existence impresses him as a sort of prison, and he wants to experience the universe as a single, significant whole, as did Galileo. So Einstein struggles with how do we communicate this cosmic religious feeling. Theosophy often says we can't put it into words. He said it is the most important function of art and science to awaken this feeling and keep it alive to those who are receptive to it. Theosophy is for those who want it. Now the world today, we know, continues to feel smaller and smaller as we're more connected by technology. And yet we feel more lost than ever before, or lonely. And perhaps the reason was figured out years ago by Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Through our scientific and technological genius, we've made of this world a neighborhood. And now through our moral and ethical commitment, we must make of it a brotherhood. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. Brotherhood. Have we forgotten we are all made of the same stuff? Have we forgotten we think and move and have our being for the benefit of soul, all of us, in every form? Have we forgotten that at the very center, the inner center of our entire nature, we are one with all? And isn't that the goal of religion, to help us understand we are made in the image of the holy and sacred? If that is true, then we are holy and sacred, as is every one of our brothers and sisters. The suffering spoken of by the Buddha is that which we feel when we believe these bodies and we act, we are these bodies and we act in selfish ways that are good just for ourselves. The suffering ceases when we remember who and what we truly are and recognize others as ourselves. Science has proven these philosophical ideas again and again and still cannot see how the puzzle fits together. Back in 1939, Semyon Kerlian, which was alluded to, saw the electromagnetic field first around pennies, believe it or not, the mineral field, then around plants. And what he did was used electricity to charge the photographic plate. And what he saw was this magnificent light surrounding the object. In pennies, it was fractured, almost like a starry shape. But in plants, it was a connected circle, in a sense. So science will admit energy is the basis of all life, that it is always changing and always moving and being redirected, and that it never dies. Yet science cannot make the leap that what was seen on the photographic plate is us. Recent experiments with water alluded to, just want to give you some of the ideas, in how feelings influence the formation of crystals. When good, healing, loving thoughts were directed to the water, when it froze, it made beautifully, perfectly symmetrical, elegant crystals. And they have pictures of it in the book, and we'll get to the reference later. And those who sent ugly or hurtful or ill thoughts to the water, the crystals formed not only ugly or disconnected crystals, but there were no patterns to them. And yet science does not believe that man influences the world around him. Rather, that patterns of behavior measured by science come from nature itself. So Einstein's deeply felt needs, they can be answered in part by science, in part by religion, and in whole by man. From Dr. King. Science investigates, religion interprets. Science gives man knowledge, which is power. Religion gives man wisdom, which is control. Science deals mainly with facts. Religion deals mainly with values. The two are not rivals. They are complementary.
Welcome your questions and comments on this ongoing dialogue between science and religion to understand the truth.
We don't know if we can speak to the beginning root to anything, but certainly science seeks answers in the realm of nature and by measurement and by quantifiable experiment. And rarely, although more now than ever before, goes outside that box. It seeks to have re-performable, quantifiable results. Religion always sought to define man's existence, place in the universe, that which created, and whether we call that God or a deific essence, sought more particularly to talk about man's place in the universe, where we think science deals with nature. Any other thoughts?
I heard that time when religion was very powerful, like the church, the science kind of carved out that area. Church is already taking charge of whatever in one area.
So science was getting in the way of religion's seek to keep hold on things, in a sense.
Okay, we'll do it this way.
Right, we'll change and we'll prove ourselves this way. We don't know the actual meaning of the word science, but we can tell you about the word religion. Religion actually means to bind back. And theosophically, we might consider that in our investigation of ourselves, man, know thyself, we bind back to that spiritual essence we have always been and always will be. And science, all we can say is that it seeks to investigate. So, in a sense, both are directional in investigation, one into the inner spiritual and one into the outer physical, perhaps.
You might say that both the words science and conscience or consciousness come from the same root, that science and consciousness meaning to know, to be conscious, to know of, or to know with knowledge, whereas science, as we understand it today, is directed outward. And this is where it comes in conflict with religion, because it's directed at the changeable aspects of life, whereas religion, as was suggested, deals with the wholeness, the interconnected, the enduring realities.
Well, our hand was up when the question was, you know, where did this
yes.
rift start between science and religion? And we recall that, you know, during a time, during the Dark Ages, when ignorance abounded and the church was in control of all aspects of life, as the time of centuries became completely irreligious and therefore materialistic, and hence the division. But you know, science, if it would adopt, and it has been, as we said, if it would adopt and recognize and learn more about the non-material side of nature, and religion, if it would free itself from the dogma, the limiting dogma that it insists upon, you know, therein lies the synthesis of it.
Exactly. And interestingly, in Galileo's story, you reminded us of it, he waited until the time was right for the church fathers to be of the nature that he thought his teachings might be accepted. And there was a cardinal who was in sympathy with these ideas, but waited until the time to bring them forward and told him, if you write them in a way that it's a hypothetical, and you also incorporate the teachings of the church, we can publish it. He made the mistake of having three characters, one a narrator, and the conversation being between a brilliant scientist giving his ideas and a simpleton giving the church's ideas. And of course, the church was livid. And what happened was they respected him enough. Instead of throwing him into prison, they put him under house arrest. So there was that impetus to begin to look at what that truth might be, but not yet enough to give over the religious dogma and its ramifications at the time of the Inquisition.
You might add that, yes, there is dialogue now going on between certain thought leaders in science and religion, but those individuals are brave pioneers. They have to deal with the reaction from their own communities. The individual woman who did the research in the bioelectric field and told you about the microorganisms and measuring the radiation. She's an advisor of the National Institute of Health and National Institute of Mental Health, and yet she's criticized by her peers, had a very difficult time getting money, and we'll tell you that many of her colleagues find her work fascinating, but will tell her right in front, well, look, we got to make a living here, we got to get grants and so forth. So there's still that element of fear that people are beginning to break through. Of course, that's the challenge for them, but what they give us through their efforts is a tremendous opportunity.
I think it was Francis Bacon that said, a little philosophy inclineth someone towards atheism, but more in-depth philosophy inclineth men towards religion. And for me, that makes sense just in terms of the evolution of the process of, you know, having been an atheistic person for myself, being when I was in my scientific phase, and it was just a natural transition. So for me, that's
so the thought being, when we begin to study, there may be an atheistic quality to it. We're not putting our ideas or our allegiance to anything in particular. And then your point was, as you go deeper, there's a religious aspect to it. And theosophy might say, as you continue, you begin to see the cords of continuity in all religion, that there are seeds of everything you heard from this room today, all over the world, in all religions and all philosophies, sort of buffeted by other ideas, and we heard other interpretations by folks that cloud those truths. So the philosopher's study, aim, and purpose is to uncover those truths and test them against what others have found and point to without name or allegiance or organization, this is truth.
Yes.
We've dealt with science and religion, but what about philosophy? That's also one of man's tools to his discovery and his search for truth. How did that escape the fray? Why is that pillaged and talked about?
We only had 15 minutes.
Well, even though there are contemporary
judgments and decisions. And really the context of mind is, as a moving force is much bigger than that, much broader than that. And really cannot be separated off into a kind of like forebrain place. It has to be integrated into the whole emotional body to really have meaning, effective meaning.
Yes. Your observations are very good in the sense that there are researchers who talk about these energy fields that were mentioned in theosophical writings in the late 1900s, early 1800s, and they're beginning to study them themselves. Now, this subject of mind, though, is not so simple. Mind, as was suggested, is a cosmic principle that's present in all departments of nature, and yet we can also say that it's faculties of mind, thought, feeling, will, imagination, and memory. We can understand ourselves to be mind-bitty beings, thinkers, experiencers, knowers. We can even refer to the mind as the incarnating ego, the mind being the soul that incarnates from life to life. So mind, indeed, cannot be taken in a limited way, but it has to be taken from universals to particulars. We can look at it in a limited way if we see it in the context of the whole, and we can also bring a holistic idea of mind down to the individual or anything.
And just to follow up then, the previous question about philosophy, we think that those three, science, religion, and philosophy, are the three best and most often used expressions of the mind expressing itself, and that truth will be found in philosophy as well.
So, and I'd say philosophy is love of truth, and except in a way it hasn't escaped the fray. Philosophy in the time of the Alexandrian schools was science. It was natural science, but as time went on, it became more metaphysical, speculative, theoretical, even getting to the point of now mathematical and looking at language. So now philosophers, as was brought out in an earlier talk, are looking at ethics, applying their principles to ethical, value-laden decisions in our life, and philosophy is coming out of the ivory tower and trying to be more practical in people's lives. So it is, in a sense, that link between science, which gives us knowledge and power, and wisdom, which tells us how to control. I'll take one more time.
Right. The word philosophy, you know, it kind of has changed over the centuries. You know, and how does it fit into this science and religion thing? We understand that in the earlier universities of Europe, if you were a doctor of philosophy, that meant you're a doctor of anything other than law, medicine, or theology. Everything else was a doctor of philosophy. That's why you get a PhD in chemistry, not a doctor of chemistry. But as a student of theosophy, if we, you know, the theosophist, if he is, you know, if he is making the effort to synthesize religion, science, and philosophy, we might look at it from this perspective. From the religious side, we are thinkers who do go from universals to particulars. The universal is the reality to particulars. From the scientific approach, it's from particulars, you know, from the particular to the universal, knowing that, you know, they're going to meet. So going from particulars to universal, it can be practical. It's not always wrong. But from the philosophical side, theosophically speaking, so one is deductive thinking, the other is inductive thinking, and philosophically, what we like to call it is eductive thinking, education, from within outward. So the philosophical side is going from within me to my outer life. What's going on within me is what's going on out there, and if I don't like what I see, what do I need to change within me? That's the philosophical approach.
We're going to move then to our final presentation, the Real New Age Awakening Global Consciousness And that title, The Real New Age, tells us that theosophy, when speaking of the New Age, is much more than the New Age that we might find in the bookstore or advertised as interest in a number of interesting psychic areas or phenomenal areas. So we'll have the theosophical perspective given in.
Thank you. Although he's not quite telling the truth. Only because the more I think about this and the more I've heard this morning and this afternoon, the less I know about the New Age. The one thing that I can think of is in the title, A New Cycle of Opportunity and Change. And so when we typically think about the New Age, we usually go online and we hear or see what's been written about Gnosticism, about paganism, about HPD as the mother of the New Age, about channeling, about crystals, about energies, about healing, about spiritual evolution, about ascending masters or whatever. That's interesting, but what does it do for us? Where does it place us? What does it awaken inside of us? Even the idea of the real New Age, what does that mean? From a theosophical perspective, we have to realize that there are wheels within wheels, so there are cycles within cycles. We are in the so-called fourth round, fifth grace, fifth subgrace, looking forward to the sixth, which implies that our level of enlightenment, our accomplishments in science at the peak of that sine curve will pale in comparison to the new races. What we consider to be enlightenment and the embracing of nature will perhaps look like a cartoon at that time. So we really can't, or this person really can't talk about the real New Age. You know, it's beyond me. But what I recognize is from hearing everything that's been said, we are talking about one principle, one life, one reality, and one awareness of that reality. Limited by the forms that we use to come to an awareness of that reality. So what would a real New Age be, perhaps? It would be the freeing of consciousness from the constraints which confine it and bias it and limit it, such that whether without, within, above, below, to the north or to the south, we can simply realize those inherent, eternal truths and laws of our own nature. So we can get beyond the idea that although we appear to be separate, we appear to be in our own isolated capsules experiencing suffering and pain, that it's a real phenomenal dream that we have to wake up from and take the position of the responsible manifestator of the entire charade. Not to say that the charade does not have value. We heard about Alexandria and the great effort. And think about this for a minute. We think about evolution from our perspective, from the point of view of the races. But the globe is bigger than us. And the relationship that the globe holds to the system is bigger than the globe. And in the aphorisms on karma, Mr. Judge tells us that the karma of this world, this globe, And if we extend that, this solar system, the galaxy, is larger than all of us, and that there are beings who hold that in their responsibility. That's an awesome thought. And so when we think about it from that perspective, we have to realize that just like we have millions of cells in our body, each of them thinking that they're individual, each of them thinking that they're going to work, taking care of their family, and living their life, that they haven't quite woken up to the fact that they are in a body. And that body requires them to work together in order to perform a greater function than any of them individually can do. So now, what do we have? We have the Alexandrias of the world and the different cycles coming together. To bring together knowledge of all kinds in one place. Why? So that perhaps we can have a meal that is non-sectarian, non-biased, doesn't deal with prejudices and principles, but opens up the infinite number of windows through which we look at life, because life is that rich. Life isn't limited to the phenomena that we see on this globe. This is, I mean, when you think about it, it's pathetic. It's amazing. But really, I mean, there's a universe out there that expresses itself that we are, if we are not hypocrites, no different than. Now, how can we conceptualize that? Easily. And I love this analogy, it's my personal favorite. Every night we go to sleep, and in the emptiness of our consciousness, we create universes, dreams, thousands of people. We create people that like us, people that hate us, people that chase us, people that kill us, and we do it over and over and over again. And sometimes there's wisdom in the creation. And then we wake up and we scratch our heads. And even though we felt it, we experienced it, we knew it was real, we realized that out of nothing comes everything. And actually, the truth of our being is more nothing than it is anything. And when we can get our invisible hands around that, we can begin to appreciate a little bit at a time that this is bigger than anything we've ever. So again, the Alexandrian libraries of the world, the Alexandrias of the world, coming together with massive amounts of knowledge dealing with the practical, the mundane, to those eclectic and esoteric schools that were supposed to introduce us to that thing that is the closest to us. The awesomeness of our own nature, which implies responsibility. So we have three fundamental propositions, theosophically speaking. The first one is that we are the absolute. And yet we limit ourselves and we are, according to our own laws of karma, led by our choices. Our teachers tell us the universe has its karma, we have our karma, the bodhisattvas have their karma, the animals have their karma, the kingdoms have their karma. Now, when we can get past conceptual terms and understand what that means from process and from force and from consciousness and from energy, different yet the same, we can get a better grip on perhaps what this march and this unfolded is about. Law is inherent within our being. Karma doesn't chase us. We wake it up. The seed has the fruit. The end of this earth is already contained in its beginning, not in a fatalistic way. But I mean, think about it. Here we have DNA. DNA dictates what form we're going to take as spiritual beings and locks us into a pseudo-reality and we believe it. And this duality of mind that Mamlevatsky tells us about is such that the part that we function from most frequently is tied up in the central nervous system. She tells us that in the article, point blank. And if we can't get beyond that, we can't get to recognize the immortal nature of our being. The whole evolutionary process, she explains it in The Secret Doctrine, arises from, as our dreams, the nature of our being. The path of evolutionary awakening and expression, not development, awakening. The soul has within it everything that it needs because it is one with that fundamental principle. And yet the expression and the awakening of that soul, if we're going to talk about it from the threefold monadic side of being, occurs limited typically by form. And so we have those that are ahead of the wave, those that are behind the wave, and those that are kind of in the midst of the wave. She talks about that in terms of the spiritual, the mental, and the psychic or physical lines of evolutionary awakening and expression. And so here we are, now in the second half of the afternoon, talking about environmental ethics. Why? Because we are the globe. And we are actually more than that, and she explains that very simply in The Secret Doctrine, depending upon how we're reading and what levels of understanding each has, because each is different. But in that ethical arrangement of the environment, as both of the students, all three, have already said, science has reached a point where it has recognized to some degree that astral realm. It has recognized to some degree that the heart holds the key to our physical consciousness, as well as our emotional consciousness, as well as is a doorway to our spiritual consciousness. And that consciousness, as we typically talk about it, is not what it really is. Because in order to do that, we have to appreciate, yes, that sixth race and that seventh race that is coming in, the senses that they will develop that will allow them to be at one with the object of their awareness, to know its nature completely. And then recognize that the essence of that object is no different than the essence of its being, and embrace it all. And that's a tremendous responsibility. Because in that recognition, and in the recognition of science with those geomagnetic fields, the cardiac fields that are feet around us, that can rule over the brain fields. And yet, if we're looking at it from the point of view of chakras, there are still fields to be discerned by science. And yet they reach out into the environment so that we pollute the environment. The environment impacts us. Mr. Judge, Madam Blavatsky, when we're talking about how our emotional nature impacts the climate, the weather, the lives, it's no different than how we, when we're happy or sad, the monk on the train, make our bodies feel. I mean, just think, if we're laughing and we're feeling good and we have that love and that compassion and we're sharing and we're understanding and we're forgetting, forgetting and forgetting, but not learning. What's going on inside of our bodies? Those rhythms that we're talking about. Science is reaching the point where it understands that information, and this is a wonderful word because we still don't know what it means, but information is encoded in rhythms, in cycles, in impressions, in sound, in electromagnetic phenomena, i.e. on the astral. We think about information as what we read in books, where it's on paper, what we talk. That's not nature's way of communication, necessarily. And so we're opening up another world into another aspect of our being in regards to what we are. Forget about who we are. That's a mask, that's a temporary thing. At heart, we are all the same power. We just prefer to act differently at this time. We can talk about personal karma and everything else, but if a meteorite hits this globe, we're in it together. I mean, that's the fact. And then we talk about the dialogue between science and religion, and we talk about the communication. I mean, my colleague gave me some references, and there are some wonderful ones online that reflect the fact that science, or some individuals in science, are waking up to the fact that we need a dialogue. We have to talk. We have to appreciate different cultural perspectives. We have to tolerate. We have to integrate. We have to transcend the egocentric perspective that we have in order to embrace a global perspective such that this little cell in the molecule that we call the solar system can function harmoniously in regards to its task, which again is greater than any task that we think of, and yet very similar. So when we're talking about the new cycle, what is it that we're really talking about? We're trying to talk about the fact that we are putting the ingredients together, if we will, for the sixth race. Madame Blavatsky said over 150 years ago, I believe, that the races are coming together, the seeds are being mixed, not for our purposes, not for our pleasure, but for a global purpose, for a global awakening, for a global awareness. Again, this is bigger than any particular individual, but not greater. Because as was indicated, we each contribute. One makes a difference. And so we are now in the process of preparing our minds, global dialogue, interfaith communication, sensitivity towards gender issues, women issues, men issues, sensitivity towards the environment, understanding how our emotions pollute it, at the same time how if we chose to live differently, the reflections from the astral light, if we talk in theosophical terms, that impact the subconscious way we think, because again, we have no idea what thought is. Most people think they're making choices, but be honest, how many choices do you actually consciously make a day? Mostly we react, we do, and we're moving. Very infrequently do we sit down and think about a true course of action to attain a true goal, i.e. intent, meditational vision, purpose, understanding of what it is that we're doing, destroyers or creators. We're trying to create instruments such that those souls that are coming in, some of which may be us, in the sixth race, are in a position to help the very globe that we are perhaps decimating now awaken to its greater potential. I mean, think about it. What's more important? The consciousness of the cell inside of your body trying to be successful? Or the consciousness of the being that the cell is a part of, trying to awaken to a greater awareness of where it fits in order to keep the cycle going. Madame Blavatsky tells us that in the seventh race, there'll be adepts walking on the face of this earth. What would they be like? They would have to be individuals that understand these very seeds that we're trying to lay down now. Interfaith communication, the understanding that there's only one essence, but people talk about things differently, so when at home, do like the wrongs, don't disturb them. Help them, help along with that civilization, talk about the morals and the ethics, talk about how to live in harmony with the earth, perhaps like the Native American Indians did at one time. Understand that our thoughts and our secret desires and our passions, for better or for worse, impact the environment tremendously and affect its evolutionary awakening and expression. We talk about being responsible for the lives that we live, but we very infrequently think about the responsibility that we have for the globe. That is still the vehicle of our being. The teachers talk about mankind as being the channel of the Buddhic force for the face of this earth. Is that what we act like as humanity? And think about it. The Buddhic force is six principles connected with seven. That's a tremendous responsibility. We can't do it if we're stuck in passions and desires and mind and egocentricity and gimme and don't like you and I'll destroy you and let's screw up the environment because I just want to be successful. It just doesn't work like that. And the interesting part of it is, since we're all here together, we're not buying anywhere. We're not. We have to remember that the spiritual entity is different than the vehicle it uses. And although substance is matter and matter is spirit, the consciousness that uses it to generate the form is not truly limited by the expression of the form. And all of these efforts and lines of force coming together will help us realize that from an experiential perspective, not from a philosophical talk it out, but from a living perspective that will mandate that we have to act with consciousness and with responsibility.
I think you'll agree that our speaker has helped summarize our meeting and perhaps answered our questions as we've entertained them in our minds. But if you do still have other questions, here's your opportunity to ask them.
We thought that Buddhic force is manas or mind wedded to that higher intuitional reservoir of Buddhi rather than the seventh principle, which is unconscious and universal and not really describable. So, or are there two different levels? One is the Buddhi manas and the other is atmic?
Basically, I would assume that's a question about the principles. And, you know, for convenience, we talk about manas, Buddhi, atma. We talk about the triad. From the perspective of the teachings, depending upon what it is you're pursuing in your life, in your understanding, and in your perhaps meditations, we do understand that manas is an impersonal force or energy. So is Buddhi, but of a different nature and of a different kind, and it is actually the vehicle for that universal force that we call Atma in its expression. Those two being the most eternal and imperishable portions of our being, whether we recognize that from the Gita or whether we recognize that from the point of view of the reincarnating ego in the theosophical terminology. But yet we still have to recognize that each round, each race, how can we put it, brings us into greater communication and greater recognition of those forces and what they contain. We very rarely talk about contents of Buddhi. We have a hard enough time talking about contents of manas. And then contents of higher manas, not to mention Buddhi manas. All different. So, yes, there's Atma Buddhi. Typically, you'll find them as one. And yet, if we have read Madame Blavatsky's Pista Sophia notes, she talks about Buddhi looking outwards. She talks about Buddhi looking inwards, and then she talks about the source that Buddhi arises from. So again, I mean, it's wonderful, it's simple, and yet very, very complex depending upon how we're making the applications, what we're trying to understand, what levels of being, what rounds, what, you know, ages we're talking about. But that's the beauty.
And yet, as you suggested, in future races, these things will be direct knowledge.
Ah.
We have much to look forward to and hope. Yes, in fact.
In the Bhagavad Gita, it speaks of the need for sacrifice in order to make the rain. And then that famous section goes on to show the chain from rain, how all this, all else is nourished. In this global age of responsibility and ethics, what is the corresponding sacrifice that would show our responsibility and knowledge at this time
What is the corresponding sacrifice such that we can receive rain, so to speak? And excuse me for being particular, but some of that depends upon the kind of rain that we're looking for. if we are talking about awakening the Bodhi Manas of the race, as Madame Blavatsky would say, then the sacrifices that we have to make sacred, because sacrifice, as we understand it, means to bring out the greatest and the most highest and the most divine within a particular thing, which is lifting up all of life. When we do that, we have divested ourselves as personalities from that, so it appears as though we've given something up. But when we do that, we are actually making sacred every aspect of our life, every aspect of our thinking. We are serving, we are, to the best of our abilities, trying to bring about a harmony in word, in thought, in act. It's that eightfold path, so to speak, of the Buddha in terms of right view, right speech, right intent, right action, right living, right meditation, right mindfulness, and right being. And if we're doing that, and we're doing that with compassion, again, as indicated in the global initiative, sending out ways of compassion, serving each other, being tolerant, understanding instead of accusing, being forgiven, and helping to build up as opposed to tear down, then the type of rain that we will receive would be abundant in regards to spirituality, in regards to psychic phenomena, in a balanced way, because that's part of our heritage as well, down to keeping the earth clean, being green, and then having it in turn sacrifice for us in terms of whether it's vegetables, life forms, oxygen, rain, water, fire, earth. So there would be a recognition of our true, I won't use the word brotherhood, humanityhood. And then that harmony would allow the greatest development for that particular vehicle that we call earth.
Yes.
This theosophy has provided some man with something that he can think about, concentrate on, to help him get a better handle, because the terms used sometimes are above our understanding as we are present.
Is there something simple that theosophy offers to help us all just get a grip and perhaps change our way of living? And yes, I mean, that's the three fundamentals. One life, one substance, one unity. We're all the same. The second having to do with law, reincarnation, periodicity. We see it every day. We live it every day. And the third having to do with self-induced and self-devised responsibility and how we treat the very forms that all of life is pervaded with in regards to brotherhood, sisterhood, humanityhood. Very simple ideas. If we could live them, there's an old expression, the mind or the brain would become porous to the influences of the soul, and we might find ourselves being compelled, as Krishna tells Arjuna, to act differently because of what we were awakening within the qualities of our being. And as the qualities awaken within our being, the light that they shed on the screen of mind is such that everything that we're investigating scientifically now, guarantee you, you will know before science does, because they are natural principles. And if they are the principles of nature, and we are part of that in our manifest being, not in our spiritual being, then that is the book of life that we use. Paracelsus used it in nature and within himself. Jacob Burma saw the same visions within himself. Ibn Arabi, the great Sufi, saw the hierarchies, the heavens, the deities on those different realms, common language. And yet there was nothing special about any of them except their devotion.
Thank you for that contribution, which really hits on a keynote of our independence, interdependence with nature, and our responsibility to it. We'd like to close by thanking all the speakers for their thoughtful preparation and concise delivery of our time. Really, any one of these subjects could be the theme for an entire conference in themselves, and we know how hard they work to shorten the talks, make them powerful.
It's always the struggle.
We'd also like to thank our guests who came down from New York and up from Washington, D.C. We'd like to thank you for your contributions and questions, and even those of you who sat in silent reflection and meditation and intent, as we know you contributed to this event and made it successful as well. So we welcome you to come back again to Philadelphia, but also to the next InterMod symposium in the year. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Ethics and morals, I guess I gotta get back on track.
Steve, I'm gonna hit this.